This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Crescendo by Becca Fitzpatrick. Read by Caitlin Greer. Prologue, Coldwater, Maine, 14 months ago. The fingers of the thorn apple tree clawed at the windowpane behind Harrison Gray, and he dog-eared his page, no longer able to read through the racket. A furious spring wind had hurled itself against the farmhouse all night, howling and whistling, causing the shutters to slam against the clapboards with a repetitive bang, bang, bang. The calendar may have been turned to March, but Harrison knew better than to think spring was on its way. With a storm blowing in, he wouldn't be surprised to find the countryside frozen in icy whiteness by morning. To drown out the wind's piercing cry, Harrison punched the remote, turning up Bononcini's Ombra Mai Fu. Then he set another log on the fire, asking himself, not for the first time, if he would have bought the farmhouse had he known how much fuel it took to warm one little room, let alone all nine. The phone shrilled. Harrison picked it up halfway through the second ring, expecting to hear the voice of his daughter's best friend, who had the annoying habit of calling at the latest possible hour the night before homework was due. Shallow, rapid breathing sounded in his ear before a voice broke the static. "We need to meet. How soon can you be here?" The voice floated through Harrison, a ghost from his past, leaving him bone cold. It had been a long time since he'd heard the voice, and hearing it now could only mean something had gone wrong. Terribly wrong. He realized the phone in his hand was slick with sweat, his posture rigid. "An hour," he answered flatly. He was slow to replace the handset. He shut his eyes, his mind unwillingly traveling back. There had been a time 15 years ago when he froze at the sound of the phone ringing, the seconds pounding out like drums as he waited for the voice on the other end to speak. Over time, as one peaceful year replaced another, he'd eventually convinced himself he was a man who'd outrun the secrets of his past. He was a man living a normal life, a man with a beautiful family, a man with nothing to fear. In the kitchen, standing over the sink, Harrison poured himself a glass of water and tossed it back. It was full dark outside, and his waxen reflection stared back from the window straight ahead. Harrison nodded, as if to tell himself everything would be all right, but his eyes were heavy with lies. He loosened his tie to relieve the tightness within him that seemed to stretch his skin, and poured a second glass. The water swam uneasily inside him, threatening to come back up. Setting the glass in the basin of the sink, he reached for the car keys on the counter, hesitating once as if to change his mind. Harrison eased the car to the curb and killed the headlights. Sitting in darkness, breath smoking, he took in the ramshackle brick row houses in a seedy section of Portland. It had been years, 15 to be exact, since he had set foot in the neighborhood, and relying on his rusty memory, he wasn't sure he was in the right place. He popped open the glove box and retrieved a time-yellowed scrap of paper. 1565 Monroe. He was about to swing out of the car, but the silence on the streets bothered him. Reaching beneath his seat, he pulled out a loaded Smith & Wesson and tucked it into the waistband of his pants at the small of his back. He hadn't aimed a gun since college, and never outside a shooting range. The only clear thought in his throbbing head was that he hoped he could still say as much an hour from now. The tap of Harrison's shoes sounded loud on the deserted pavement, but he ignored the rhythm, choosing instead to focus his attention on the shadows cast by the silver moon. Hunkering deeper into his coat, he passed cramped dirt yards boxed in by chain-link fences, the houses beyond them dark and eerily quiet. Twice he felt as if he was being followed, but when he glanced back, there was no one. At 1565 Monroe, he let himself through the gate and circled around to the back of the house. He knocked once and saw a shadow move behind the lace curtains. The door cracked. "It's me," Harrison said, keeping his voice low. The door opened just wide enough to admit him. "Were you followed?" he was asked. "No." "She's in trouble." Harrison's heart quickened. What kind of trouble? Once she turns 16, he'll come for her. You need to take her far away, someplace where he'll never find her. Harrison shook his head. I don't understand. He was cut off by a menacing glare. When we made this agreement, I told you there would be things you couldn't understand. 16 is a cursed age in my world. That's all you need to know, he finished brusquely.
The two men watched each other until at last Harrison gave a wary nod.
You have to cover your tracks, he was told. Wherever you go, you have to start over. No one can know you came from Maine. No one. He'll never stop looking for her. Do you understand?
I understand.
But would his wife? Would Nora? Harrison's vision was adapting to the darkness, and he noted with curious disbelief that the man standing before him appeared not to have aged a day since their last meeting. In fact, he hadn't aged a day since college, when they'd met as roommates and become fast friends. A trick of the shadows, Harrison wondered. There was nothing else to attribute it to. One thing had changed, though. There was a small scar at the base of his friend's throat. Harrison took a closer look at the disfigurement and flinched. A burn mark, raised and shiny, hardly larger than a quarter. It was in the shape of a clenched fist. To his shock and horror, Harrison realized his friend had been branded, like cattle. His friend sensed the direction of Harrison's gaze and his eyes turned steely, defensive.
There are people who want to destroy me, who want to demoralize and dehumanize me. Together with a trusted friend, I've formed a society. More members are being initiated all the time.
He stopped mid-breath, as if unsure how much more he should say, then finished hastily.
We organized the society to give us protection, and I've sworn allegiance to it. If you know me as well as you once did, you know I'll do whatever it takes to protect my interests.
He paused and added almost absently, and my future.
They branded you,
Harrison said, hoping his friend didn't detect the repulsion that shuddered through him. His friend merely looked at him. After a moment, Harrison nodded, signaling he understood, even if he didn't accept it. The less he knew, the better. His friend had made that clear too many times to count.
Is there anything else I can do? Just keep her safe.
Harrison pushed his glasses up the bridge of his nose. He began awkwardly.
I thought you might like to know she's grown up healthy and strong. We named her Nora. I don't want to be reminded of her name,
his friend interrupted harshly.
I've done everything in my power to stamp it out from my mind. I don't want to know anything about her. I want my mind washed of any trace of her, so I've got nothing to give that bastard.
He turned his back, and Harrison took the gesture to mean the conversation was over. Harrison stood a moment, so many questions at the tip of his tongue, but at the same time, knowing nothing good would come from pressing. Stifling his need to make sense of this dark world his daughter had done nothing to deserve, he let himself out. He'd only made it a half block when a gunshot ripped through the night. Instinctively, Harrison dropped low and whirled around. His friend. A second shot was fired, and without thinking, he ran in a dead sprint back toward the house. He shoved through the gate and cut around the side yard. He had almost rounded the final corner when arguing voices caused him to stop. Despite the cold, he was sweating. The backyard was shrouded in darkness, and he inched along the garden wall, careful to avoid kicking loose stones that would give him away, until the back door came into sight.
"Last chance," said a smooth, calm voice Harrison didn't recognize. "Go to hell," his friend spat.
A third gunshot. His friend bellowed in pain, and the shooter called over him, "Where is she?" Heart hammering, Harrison knew he had to act. Another 5 seconds and it could be too late. He slid his hand to his lower back and drew the gun. Two-handing it to steady his grip, he moved toward the doorway, approaching the dark-haired shooter from behind. Harrison saw his friend beyond the shooter, but when he made eye contact, his friend's expression filled with alarm.
Go!
Harrison heard his friend's order as loud as a bell, and for a moment believed it had been shouted out loud. But when the shooter didn't spin around in surprise, Harrison realized with cold confusion that his friend's voice had sounded inside his head.
No, Harrison thought back with a silent shake of his head, his sense of loyalty outweighing what he couldn't comprehend. This was the man he'd spent 4 of the best years of his life with, the man who'd introduced him to his wife. He wasn't going to leave him here at the hands of a killer. Harrison pulled the trigger. He heard the ear-splitting shot and waited for the shooter to crumple. Harrison shot another time, and another. The dark-haired young man turned slowly. For the first time in his life, Harrison found himself truly afraid. Afraid of the young man standing before him, gun in hand. Afraid of death. Afraid of what would become of his family. He felt the shots rip through him with a searing fire that seemed to shatter him into 1,000 pieces. He dropped to his knees. He saw his wife's face blur across his vision, followed by his daughter's. He opened his mouth, their names at his lips, and tried to find a way to say how much he loved them before it was too late. The young man had his hands on Harrison now, dragging him into the alley at the rear of the house. Harrison could feel consciousness leaving him as he struggled without success to get his feet under him. He couldn't fail his daughter. There would be no one to protect her. This black-haired shooter would find her, and if his friend was right, kill her. "Who are you?" Harrison asked, the words causing fire to spread through his chest. He clung to the hope that there was still time. Maybe he could warn Nora from the next world, a world that was closing in on him like 1,000 falling feathers painted black. The young man watched Harrison for a moment before the faintest of smiles broke his ice-hard expression. "You thought wrong. It's definitely too late." Harrison looked up sharply, startled that the killer had guessed his thoughts, and couldn't help but wonder how many times the young man had stood in this same position before to guess a dying man's final thoughts. Not a few. As if to prove just how practiced he was, the young man aimed the gun without a single beat of hesitation, and Harrison found himself staring into the barrel of the weapon. The light of the fired shot flared, and it was the last image he saw. Chapter 1. Delphic Beach, Maine. Present Day. Patch was standing behind me, his hands on my hips, his body relaxed. He stood 2 inches over 6 feet tall and had a lean, athletic build that even loose-fit jeans and a t-shirt couldn't conceal. The color of his hair gave midnight a run for its money, with eyes to match. His smile was sexy and warned of trouble, but I'd made up my mind that not all trouble was bad. Overhead, fireworks lit up the night sky, raining streams of color into the Atlantic. The crowd oohed and awed. It was late June and Maine was jumping into summer with both feet, celebrating the beginning of 2 months of sun, sand, and tourists with deep pockets. I was celebrating 2 months of sun, sand, and plenty of exclusive time with Patch. I'd enrolled in 1 summer school course, chemistry, and had every intention of letting Patch monopolize the rest of my free time. The fire department was setting off the fireworks on a dock that couldn't have been more than 200 yards down the beach from where we stood, and I felt the boom of each one vibrate in the sand under my feet. Waves crashed into the beach just down the hill, and carnival music tinkled at top volume. The smell of cotton candy, popcorn, and sizzling meat hung thick in the air, and my stomach reminded me I hadn't eaten since lunch. "I'm going to grab a cheeseburger," I told Patch. "Want anything?"
"Nothing on the menu."
I smiled. "Why, Patch, are you flirting with me?" He kissed the crown of my head.
"Not yet. I'll grab your cheeseburger. Enjoy the last of the fireworks."
I snagged one of his belt loops to stop him. "Thanks, but I'm ordering. I can't take the guilt." He raised his eyebrows in inquiry. "When was the last time the girl at the hamburger stand let you pay for food?"
"It's been a while."
"It's been never. Stay here. If she sees you, I'll spend the rest of the night with a guilty conscience." Patch opened his wallet and pulled out a 20.
"Leave her a nice tip."
It was my turn to raise my eyebrows. "Trying to redeem yourself for all those times you took free food?"
"Last time I paid, she chased me down and shoved the money in my pocket. I'm trying to avoid another groping."
It sounded made up, but knowing Patch, it was probably true. I hunted down the end of a long line that wrapped around the hamburger stand, finding it near the entrance to the indoor carousel. Judging by the size of the line,
I estimated a 15-minute wait just to place my order. One hamburger stand on the entire beach. It felt un-American. After a few minutes of restless waiting, I was taking what must have been my 10th bored look around when I spotted Marcy Miller standing two spots back. Marcy and I had gone to school together since kindergarten, and in the 11 years since, I'd seen more of her than I cared to remember. Because of her, the whole school had seen more of my underwear than necessary. In junior high, Marcy's usual M.O. was stealing my bra from my gym locker and pinning it to the bulletin board outside the main offices. But occasionally she got creative and used it as a centerpiece in the cafeteria. Both my A cups filled with vanilla pudding and topped with maraschino cherries. Classy, I know. Marcy's skirts were two sizes too small and 5 inches too short. Her hair was strawberry blonde, and she had the shape of a popsicle stick. Turn her sideways and she practically disappeared. If there was a scoreboard keeping track of wins and losses between us, I was pretty sure Marcy had double my score. "Hey," I said, unintentionally catching her eye and not seeing any way around a bare minimum greeting. "Hey," she returned in what scraped by as a civil tone. Seeing Marcy at Delphic Beach tonight was like playing What's Wrong with This Picture. Marcy's dad owned the Toyota dealership in Coldwater. Her family lived in an upscale hillside neighborhood, and the Millers took pride in being the only citizens of Coldwater welcomed into the prestigious Harrisiket Yacht Club. At this very minute, Marcy's parents were probably in Freeport, racing sailboats and ordering salmon. By contrast, Delphic was a slum beach. The thought of a yacht club was laughable. The sole restaurant came in the form of a whitewashed hamburger stand with your choice of ketchup or mustard. On a good day, fries were offered in the mix. The entertainment slanted toward loud arcades and bumper cars, and after dark, the parking lot was known to sell more drugs than a pharmacy. Not the kind of atmosphere Mr. and Mrs. Miller would have their daughter polluting herself in. "Could we move any slower, people?" Marcy called up the line. "Some of us are starving to death back here." "There's only one person working the counter," I told her. "So? They should hire more people. Supply and demand." Given her GPA, Marcy was the last person who should be spouting economics. 10 minutes later, I'd made progress, and stood close enough to the hamburger stand to read the word mustard scribbled in black magic marker on the communal yellow squirt bottle. Behind me, Marcy did the whole shifting weight between hips and sighing thing. "Starving with a capital S," she complained. The guy in line ahead of me paid and carried off his food. "A cheeseburger and a Coke," I told the girl working the stand. While she stood over the grill making my order, I turned back to Marcy. "So, who are you here with?" I didn't particularly care who she'd come with, especially since we didn't share any of the same friends. But my sense of courtesy got the better of me. Besides, Marcy hadn't done anything overtly rude to me in weeks, and we'd stood in relative peace the past 15 minutes. Maybe it was the beginning of a truce. Bygones and all that. She yawned, as if talking to me was more boring than waiting in line and staring at the backs of people's heads. "No offense, but I'm not in a chatty mood. I've been in line for what feels like 5 hours, waiting on an incompetent girl who obviously can't cook 2 hamburgers at once." The girl behind the counter had her head ducked low, concentrating on peeling pre-made hamburger patties from the wax paper, but I knew she'd heard. She probably hated her job. She probably secretly spat on the hamburger patties when she turned her back. I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of her shift, she went out to her car and wept. "Doesn't your dad mind that you're hanging out at Delphic Beach?" I asked Marcy, narrowing my eyes ever so slightly. "Might tarnish the estimable Miller family reputation, especially now that your dad's been accepted into the Harrisiket Yacht Club." Marcy's expression cooled. "I'm surprised your dad doesn't mind you're here. Oh, wait, that's right. He's dead." My initial reaction was shock. My second was indignation at her cruelty. A knot of anger swelled in my throat. "What?" she argued with a one-shoulder shrug. "He's dead. It's a fact. Do you want me to lie about the facts?" "What did I ever do to you?" "You were born." Her complete lack of sensitivity yanked me inside out, so much so that I didn't even have a comeback. I snatched my cheeseburger and Coke off the counter, leaving the 20 in its place. I wanted badly to hurry back to Patch, but this was between me and Marcy. If I showed up now, one look at my face would tell Patch something was wrong.
I didn't need to drag him into the middle. Taking a moment alone to collect myself, I found a bench within sight of the hamburger stand and sat down as gracefully as I could, not wanting to give Marcy the power to ruin my night. The only thing that could make this moment worse was knowing she was watching. Satisfied, she'd stuffed me into a little black hole of self-pity. I took a bite of cheeseburger, but it left a bad taste in my mouth. All I could think of was dead meat, dead cows, my own dead father. I threw the cheeseburger into the trash and kept walking, feeling tears slip down the back of my throat. Hugging my arms tightly at the elbows, I hurried toward the shack of bathrooms at the edge of the parking lot, hoping to make it behind a stall door before the tears started falling. There was a steady line trickling out of the women's room, but I edged my way through the doorway and positioned myself in front of one of the grime-coated mirrors. Even under the low-watt bulb, I could tell my eyes were red and glassy. I wet a paper towel and pressed it to my eyes. What was Marcy's problem? What had I ever done to her that was cruel enough to deserve this? Drawing a few stabilizing breaths, I squared my shoulders and constructed a brick wall in my mind, placing Marcy on the far side of it. What did I care what she said? I didn't even like her. Her opinion meant nothing. She was rude and self-centered and attacked below the belt. She didn't know me, and she definitely didn't know my dad. Crying over a single word that fell from her mouth was a waste. Get over it, I told myself. I waited until the red rimming my eyes faded before leaving the restroom. I roamed the crowd looking for Patch, and found him at one of the ball toss games, his back to me. Rickson was at his side, probably wagering money on Patch's inability to knock over a single weighted bowling pin. Rickson was a fallen angel who had a long history with Patch, and their ties ran deep to the point of brotherhood. Patch didn't let many people into his life, and trusted even fewer, but if there was one person who knew all his secrets, it was Rickson. Up until 2 months ago, Patch had also been a fallen angel. Then he saved my life, earned his wings back, and became my guardian angel. He was supposed to play for the good guys now, but I secretly sensed that his connection to Rickson and the world of fallen angels meant more to him. And even though I didn't want to admit it, I sensed that he regretted the Archangel's decision to make him my guardian. After all, it wasn't what he wanted. He wanted to become human. My cell phone rang, jarring me from my thoughts. It was my best friend V's ringtone, but I let voicemail take her call. With a squeeze of guilt, I vaguely noted it was the second call of hers I'd avoided today. I justified my guilt with the thought that I'd see her first thing tomorrow. Patch, on the other hand, I wouldn't see again until tomorrow evening. I planned to enjoy every minute I had with him. I watched him pitch the ball at a table neatly lined with 6 bowling pins, my stomach giving a little flutter when his t-shirt crept up in the back, revealing a stripe of skin. I knew from experience that every inch of him was hard, defined muscle. His back was smooth and perfect, too. The scars from when he'd fallen, once again replaced with wings. Wings I, and every other human, couldn't see. $5 says he can't do it again, I said, coming up behind him. Patch looked back and grinned. I don't want your money, Angel. Hey now, kids, let's keep this discussion PG-rated, Rickson said. All 3 remaining pins, I challenged Patch. What kind of prize are we talking about? He asked. Bloody hell, Rickson said. Can't this wait until you're alone? Patch gave me a secret smile, then shifted his weight back, cradling the ball into his chest. He dropped his right shoulder, brought his arm around, and sent the ball flying forward as hard as he could. There was a loud crack, and the remaining 3 pins scattered off the table. Aye, now you're in trouble, lass, Rickson shouted at me over the commotion caused by a pocket of onlookers, who were clapping and whistling for Patch. Patch leaned back against the booth and arched his eyebrows at me. The gesture said it all. Pay up. You got lucky, I said. I'm about to get lucky. Choose a prize, the old man running the booth barked at Patch, bending to pick up the fallen pins. The purple bear, Patch said, and accepted a hideous-looking teddy bear with matted purple fur. He held it out to me. For me, I said, pressing a hand to my heart. You like the rejects. At the grocery store, you always take the dented cans. I've been paying attention. He hooked his finger in the waistband of my jeans and pulled me close.
Let's get out of here.
What did you have in mind? But I was all warm and fluttery inside because I knew exactly what he had in mind.
Your place?
I shook my head. Not going to happen. My mom's home. We could go to your place, I hinted. We'd been together 2 months and I still didn't know where Patch lived, and not for lack of trying. 2 weeks into a relationship seemed long enough to be invited over, especially since Patch lived alone. 2 months felt like overkill. I was trying to be patient, but my curiosity kept getting in the way. I knew nothing about the private, intimate details of Patch's life, like the color of paint on his walls, if his can opener was electric or manual, the brand of soap he showered with, if his sheets were cotton or silk. Let me guess, I said. You live in a secret compound buried in the underbelly of the city.
Angel.
Are there dishes in the sink? Dirty underwear on the floor? It's a lot more private than my place.
True, but the answer's still no.
Has Rickson seen your place?
Rickson is need to know.
I'm not need to know. His mouth twitched.
There's a dark side to need to know.
If you showed me, you'd have to kill me, I guessed. He wrapped his arms around me and kissed my forehead.
Close enough. What time's curfew?
10. Summer school starts tomorrow. That and my mom had practically taken a part-time job finding opportunities to drop the knife between me and Patch. If I'd been out with V, I could say with absolute certainty that my curfew would have been stretched to 10:30. I couldn't blame my mom for not trusting Patch. There was a point in my life when I'd felt similarly. But it would have been extremely convenient if every now and then she relaxed her vigilance. Like, say, tonight. Besides, nothing was going to happen. Not with my guardian angel standing inches away. Patch looked at his watch.
Time to roll.
At 10:04, Patch flipped a U-turn in front of the farmhouse and parked by the mailbox. He cut the engine and the headlights, leaving us alone in the dark countryside. We sat that way for several moments before he said,
Why so quiet, Angel?
I instantly snapped to attention. Am I being quiet? Just lost in thought. A barely there smile curved Patch's mouth.
Liar. What's wrong?
You're good, I said. His smile widened a fraction.
Really good.
I ran into Marcy Miller at the hamburger stand, I admitted. So much for keeping my troubles to myself. Obviously, they were still smoldering under the surface. On the other hand, if I couldn't talk to Patch, who could I talk to? 2 months ago, our relationship involved a lot of spontaneous kissing inside our cars, outside our cars, under the bleachers, and on top of the kitchen table. It also involved a lot of wandering hands, tousled hair, and smudged lip gloss. But it was so much more than that now. I felt connected to Patch emotionally. His friendship meant more to me than 100 casual acquaintances. When my dad died, he'd left a huge hollowness inside me that threatened to eat me from the inside out. The emptiness was still there, but the ache didn't cut half as deep. I didn't see the point in staying frozen in the past, when I had everything I wanted right now. And I had Patch to thank for that. She was thoughtful enough to remind me my dad is dead.
Want me to talk to her?
That sounds a bit the Godfather.
What started the war between the two of you?
That's the thing. I don't even know. It used to be over who got the last chocolate milk in the lunch crate. Then one day in junior high, Marcy marched into school and spray-painted whore on my locker. She didn't even try to be sneaky about it. The whole school was looking on.
She went postal just like that? No reason?
Yep. No reason I was aware of, anyway. He tucked one of my curls behind my ear.
Who's winning the war?
Marcy. But not by much. His smile grew.
Go get her, Tiger.
And here's another thing. Whore? In junior high, I hadn't even kissed anyone. Marcy should have spray-painted her own locker.
Starting to sound like you've got a hang-up, Angel.
He slid his finger under the strap of my tank top, his touch sending electricity humming along my skin.
I bet I can take your mind off Marcy.
A few lights were burning in the upper level of the farmhouse. But since I didn't see my mom's face pressed up against any of the windows, I figured we had some time. I unlatched my seatbelt and bent across the console, finding Patch's mouth in the darkness. I kissed him slowly, savoring the taste of sea salt on his skin. He'd shaved this morning, but now his stubble rasped my chin. His mouth skimmed my throat, and I felt a touch of tongue, causing my heart to bump against my ribs. His kiss moved to my bare shoulder. He nudged the strap of my tank top down and brushed his mouth lower along my arm. Right then, I wanted to be as close to him as I could. I never wanted him to go. I needed him in my life right now, and tomorrow, and the day after. I needed him like I'd never needed anyone. I crawled over the console, straddling his lap. I slid my hands up his chest, grasped him behind the neck, and pulled him in. His arms circled my waist, locking me against him, and I snuggled in deeper. Caught up in the moment, I ran my hands under his shirt, thinking only of how I loved the feel of his body heat spreading into my hands. As soon as my fingers brushed the place on his back where his wing scars used to be, a distant light exploded at the back of my mind. Perfect darkness ruptured by one burst of blinding light. It was like watching a cosmic phenomenon in space from millions of miles away. I felt my mind being sucked inside patches, into all the thousands of private memories stored there, when suddenly he took my hand and slid it lower, away from the place where his wings joined with his back, and everything spun sharply back to normal.
"Nice try," he murmured, his lips brushing mine as he spoke.
I nibbled his lower lip. "If you could see into my past just by touching my back, you'd have a hard time resisting the temptation, too."
"I have a hard time keeping my hands off you without that added bonus."
I laughed, but my expression quickly turned serious. Even with considerable concentration, I could hardly remember what life had been like without Patch. At night, when I lay in bed, I could remember with perfect clarity the low timbre of his laugh, the way his smile curved slightly higher on the right, the touch of his hands, hot, smooth, and delicious on my skin. But it was only with serious effort that I could pick up memories from the previous 16 years. Maybe because those memories paled in comparison to Patch. Or maybe because there was nothing good there at all. "Don't ever leave me," I told Patch, hooking a finger in the collar of his shirt and pulling him close.
"You're mine, Angel," he murmured,
brushing the words across my jawbone as I arched my neck higher, inviting him to kiss everywhere.
"You have me forever."
"Show me you mean it," I said solemnly. He studied me a moment, then reached behind his neck and unclasped the plain silver chain he'd worn since the day I met him. I had no idea where the chain had come from, or the significance behind it, but I sensed it was important to him. It was the only piece of jewelry he wore, and he kept it tucked under his shirt next to his skin. I'd never seen him take it off. His hand slid to the nape of my neck, where he fastened the chain. The metal fell on my skin, still warm from him.
"I was given this when I was an archangel," he said, "to help me discern truth from deception."
I fingered it gently, in awe of its importance. "Does it still work?"
"Not for me."
He interlaced our fingers and turned my hand over to kiss my knuckles.
"Your turn."
I twisted a small copper ring off the middle finger of my left hand and held it out to him. A heart was hand-carved into the smooth underside of the ring. Patch held the ring between his fingers, silently examining it. "My dad gave it to me the week before he was killed," I said.
Patch's eyes flicked up. "I can't take this."
"It's the most important thing in the world to me. I want you to have it." I bent his fingers, folding them around the ring.
"Nora," he hesitated, "I can't take this."
"Promise me you'll keep it. Promise me nothing will ever come between us." I held his eyes, refusing to let him turn away. "I don't want to be without you. I don't want this to ever end." Patch's eyes were slate black, darker than a million secrets stacked on top of each other. He dropped his gaze to the ring in his hand, turning it over slowly. "Swear you'll never stop loving me," I whispered. Ever so slightly, he nodded. I gripped his collar and pulled him against me, kissing him more fervently, sealing the promise between us. I locked my fingers between his, the sharp edge of the ring biting into our palms. Nothing I did seemed to bring me close enough to him. No amount of him was enough. The ring ground deeper into my hand until I was certain it had broken skin. A blood promise. When I thought my chest might collapse without air, I pulled away, resting my forehead against his. My eyes were shut, my breathing causing my shoulders to rise and fall. "I love you," I murmured. "More than I think I should." I waited for him to answer, but instead his hold on me tightened, almost protectively. He turned his head toward the woods across the road. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"I heard something."
"That was me saying I love you," I said, smiling as I traced his mouth with my finger. I expected him to return the smile, but his eyes were still fixed on the trees, which cast shifting shadows as their branches nodded in the breeze. "What's out there?" I asked, following his gaze. "A coyote?"
"Something isn't right."
My blood chilled and I slid off his lap. "You're starting to scare me. Is it a bear?" We hadn't seen bears in years, but the farmhouse was pushed out on the very edge of town, and bears were known to wander closer to town after hibernation, when they were hungry and searching for food. "Turn the headlights on and honk the horn," I said. Training my eyes on the woods, I watched for movement. My heart edged up a little, remembering the time my parents and I had watched from the farmhouse windows as a bear rocked our car, smelling food inside. Behind me, the porch lights flashed. I didn't need to turn back to know my mom was standing in the doorway, frowning and tapping her foot. "What is it?" I asked Patch once more. "My mom's coming out. Is she safe?" He turned on the engine and put the Jeep in drive.
"Go inside. There's something I need to do."
"Go inside? Are you kidding? What's going on?"
"Nora!"
my mom called, coming down the steps, her tone aggravated. She stopped 5 feet from the Jeep and motioned for me to lower the window. "Patch?" I tried again.
"I'll call you later."
My mom hauled the door open. "Patch?" she acknowledged curtly.
"Blythe."
He gave a distracted nod. She turned to me. "You're 4 minutes late." "I was 4 minutes early yesterday." "Rollover minutes don't work with curfews. Inside, now." Not wanting to leave until Patch answered me, but not seeing much of a choice, I told him, "Call me." He nodded once, but the singular focus to his eyes told me his thoughts were elsewhere. As soon as I was out of the car and on solid ground, the Jeep revved forward, not wasting time accelerating. Wherever Patch was going, it was in a hurry. "When I give you a curfew, I expect you to keep it," Mom said. 4 minutes late," I said, my tone suggesting she might be overreacting. That earned me a stare that had disapproval stamped all over it. "Last year, your dad was killed. A couple months ago, you had your own brush with death. I think I've earned the right to be overprotective." She walked stiffly back to the house, arms clamped over her chest. "Okay. I was an unfeeling, insensitive daughter. Point taken." I turned my attention to the row of trees at the edge of the road opposite. Nothing looked out of the ordinary. I waited for a chill to warn me there was something back there, something I couldn't see, but nothing felt off. A warm summer breeze rustled past, the sound of cicadas filling the air. If anything, the woods looked peaceful under the silver glow of moonlight. Patch hadn't seen anything in the woods. He'd turned away because I'd said 3 very big, very stupid words, which had gushed out before I could stop them. What had I been thinking? No. What was Patch thinking now? Had he driven off to escape responding? I was pretty sure I knew the answer. And I was pretty sure it explained why I was left staring at the back of his Jeep. Chapter 2. For the last 11 seconds, I'd been lying face down, hugging my pillow over my head, trying to shut out Chuck Delaney's traffic report from downtown Portland, which was coming through my alarm clock loud and clear. Likewise, I was trying to shut out the logical part of my brain, which shouted for me to get dressed, promising repercussions if I didn't. But the pleasure-seeking part of my brain won out. It clung to my dream, or rather the subject of my dream. He had wavy black hair and a killer smile. At this moment, he was sitting backward on his motorcycle, and I was sitting facing forward, our knees touching. I curled my fingers into his shirt and pulled him in for a kiss. In my dream, Patch felt it when I kissed him, not only on an emotional level, but a real physical touch. In my dream, he became more human than angel. Angels can't feel physical sensation. I knew this. But in my dream, I wanted Patch to feel the soft, silky pressure of our lips connecting. I wanted him to feel my fingers pushing through his hair. I needed him to feel the thrilling and undeniable magnetic field pulling every molecule in his body toward mine. Just like I did. Patch ran his finger under the silver chain at my neck, his touch sending a shiver of pleasure rippling through me. "I love you," he murmured. Bracing my fingertips on his hard stomach, I leaned in, stopping just short of a kiss. "I love you more," I said, brushing his mouth as I spoke. Only the words didn't come out. They stayed caught in my throat. While Patch waited for me to respond, his smile faltered. "I love you," I tried again. Once again, the words stayed clamped inside. Patch's expression turned anxious. "I love you, Nora," he repeated. I nodded frantically, but he'd turned away. He swung off the motorcycle and left without looking back. "I love you," I yelled after him. "I love you, I love you." But it was as if quicksand had been poured down my throat. The harder I tried to wrestle the words out, the faster they were towed under. Patch was slipping away in a crowd. Night had fallen down around us in a snap, and I could barely distinguish his black t-shirt from the hundreds of other dark shirts in the masses. I ran to catch up, but when I grabbed his arm, it was someone else who turned around. A girl. It was too dark to get a good read on her features, but I could tell she was beautiful. "I love Patch," she told me, smiling through shocking red lipstick, "and I'm not afraid to say it." "I did say it," I argued. "Last night I told him." I pushed past her, eyes scanning the crowd until I caught a glimpse of Patch's trademark blue ball cap. I shoved my way frantically over to him and reached out to catch his hand. He turned back, but he'd changed into the same beautiful girl. "You're too late," she said. "I love Patch now."
"Over to Angie with weather," Chuck Delaney yapped cheerfully in my ear.
My eyes sprang open at the word weather. I lay in bed a moment trying to shake off what was nothing more than a bad dream and get my bearings. The weather was announced at 20 before the hour, and there was no possible way I was hearing the weather unless... summer school! I'd overslept! Kicking back the covers, I fled to the closet. Shoving my feet into the same jeans I'd discarded at the bottom of the closet last night, I stretched a white tee over my head and layered it with a lavender cardigan. I speed-dialed Patch, but 3 rings later was sent to voicemail. "Call me," I said, pausing a half-second to wonder if he was avoiding me after last night's big confession. I'd made up my mind to pretend it had never happened until it blew over and things returned to normal. But after this morning's dream, I was beginning to doubt I'd let go of it that easily. Maybe Patch was having just as hard a time dropping it. Either way, there wasn't a lot I could do about it right now, even though I could have sworn he'd promised me a ride. I pushed a headband into my hair in lieu of a hairstyle, snatched my backpack off the kitchen counter, and rushed out the door. I paused in the driveway long enough to give a scream of exasperation at the 8-by-10-foot slab of cement where my 1979 Fiat Spider used to sit. My mom had sold the Spider to pay off a 3 months delinquent electricity bill and to stock our fridge with enough groceries to keep us fed through the end of the month. She'd even dismissed our housekeeper, Dorothea, a.k.a. my surrogate parent, to trim expenses. Sending a hateful thought in the direction of circumstance, I slung my backpack over my shoulder and started jogging. Most people might consider the rural Maine farmhouse my mom and I live in quaint, but the truth is, there's nothing quaint about the mile-long jog to the nearest neighbors. And unless quaint is synonymous with 18th-century drafty money pit situated in the eye of an atmospheric inversion that sucks in all the fog from here to the coast, I beg to differ. At the corner of Hawthorne and Beach, I saw signs of life as cars zipped along on their morning commute. I used one hand to stick my thumb in the air and the other to unwrap a piece of breath-freshening, toothpaste-replacing gum. A red Toyota 4Runner braked at the curb and the passenger window lowered with an automated hum. Marcy Miller sat behind the wheel. "Car trouble?" she asked. Car trouble as in no car. Not that I was about to admit it to Marcy. "Need a ride?" she rephrased impatiently when I failed to answer. I couldn't believe out of all the cars passing down this stretch of road, Marcy's had to be the one to stop. Did I want to ride with Marcy? No.
Was I still worked up over what she'd said about my dad? Yes. Was I about to forgive her? Absolutely not. I would have gestured for her to keep driving, but there was one small snag. Rumor had it that the only thing Mr. Laux liked more than the periodic table of the elements was handing out detention slips to tardy students.
Thanks, I accepted reluctantly. I'm on my way to school.
Guess your fat friend couldn't give you a ride?
I froze with my hand on the door handle. V and I had long ago given up educating small-minded people that fat and curvy are not the same thing, but that didn't mean we tolerated the ignorance. And I would have gladly called V for a ride, but she'd been invited to attend a training meeting for hopeful editors of the school's e-zine and was already at school. On second thought, I'll walk. I gave Marcy's door a shove, locking it back in position. Marcy tried on a confused face.
Are you offended that I called her fat? Because it's true. What is it with you? I feel like everything I say has to be censored. First your dad, now this. What happened to freedom of speech?
For a split moment, I thought it would be nice and convenient if I still had the spider. Not only would I not be stranded without a ride, but I might get the pleasure of plowing Marcy over. The school parking lot was chaotic after school. Accidents happened. Since I couldn't bounce Marcy off my front fender, I did the next best thing.
If my dad owned the Toyota dealership, I think I'd be environmentally minded enough to ask for a hybrid.
Well, your dad doesn't own the Toyota dealership.
That's right. My dad's dead.
She raised one shoulder.
You said it, not me.
From now on, I think it's better if we stay out of each other's way. She examined her manicure.
Fine.
Good.
Just trying to be nice and look where it got me, she said under her breath.
Nice? You called V fat.
I also offered you a ride.
She floored the gas, her tires spitting up road dust that wafted in my direction. I hadn't woken up this morning looking for another reason to hate Marcy Miller, but there you go. Coldwater High had been erected in the late 19th century, and the construction was an eclectic mix of Gothic and Victorian that looked more cathedral than academic. The windows were narrow and arched, the glass leaded. The stone was multicolored, but mostly gray. In the summer, ivy crawled up the exterior and gave the school a certain New England charm. In the winter, the ivy resembled long skeletal fingers choking the building. I was half-speed-walking, half-jogging down the hall to chemistry when my cell phone rang in my pocket.
Mom?
I answered, not slowing my pace.
Can I call you back?
You'll never guess who I ran into last night. Lynn Parnell. You remember the Parnells, Scott's mom? I peeked at the clock on my cell. I'd been fortunate enough to hitch a ride to school with a complete stranger, a woman on her way to kickboxing at the gym, but I was still cutting it short. Less than 2 minutes to the tardy bell.
Mom, school's about to start. Can I call you at lunch?
You and Scott were such good friends.
She'd triggered a faint memory.
When we were 5, I said.
Didn't he always wet his pants?
I had drinks with Lynn last night. She just finalized her divorce, and she and Scott are moving back to Coldwater.
That's great. I'll call you.
I invited them over for dinner tonight. As I passed the principal's office, the minute hand on the clock above her door ticked to the next notch. From where I stood, it looked caught between 7:59 and 8 sharp. I aimed a threatening look at it that said, "Don't you dare ring early."
"Tonight's not good, Mom. Patch and I..."
"Don't be silly," Mom cut across me. "Scott is one of your oldest friends in the world. You knew him long before Patch."
"Scott used to force me to eat roly-polies," I said, my memory starting to come around.
"And you never forced him to play Barbies?"
"Totally different."
"Tonight, 7 o'clock, Mom said in a voice that shut out all argument. I hurried into chemistry with seconds to spare and slid onto a metal stool behind a black granite lab table on the front row. Seating was 2 to a table, and I had my fingers crossed that I'd get paired with someone whose understanding of science surpassed my own, which, given my standard, wasn't hard to beat. I tended to be more of a romantic than a realist, and chose blind faith over cold logic, which put science and me at odds right from the start. Marcy Miller strolled into the room wearing heels, jeans, and a silk top from Banana Republic that I had on my back-to-school wish list. By Labor Day, the shirt would be on the clearance rack and in my price range.
I was in the process of mentally wiping the shirt off the list when Marcy settled onto the stool beside me.
"What's up with your hair?" she said. "Ran out of mousse? Patience?"
A smile lifted one side of her mouth.
"Or is it because you had to run 4 miles to get here on time?"
What happened to staying out of each other's way? I gave a pointed look at her stool, then mine, communicating that 24 inches wasn't staying out of the way.
"I need something from you."
I exhaled silently, stabilizing my blood pressure. I should have known.
"Here's the thing, Marcy," I said. "We both know this class is going to be insanely hard. Let me do you a favor and warn you that science is my worst subject.
The only reason I'm doing summer school is because I heard chemistry is easier this term. You don't want me as a partner. This won't be an easy A."
"Do I look like I'm sitting beside you for the health of my GPA?" she said with an impatient flip of her wrist. "I need you for something else. Last week, I got a job."
"Marcy, a job?" She smirked, and I could only imagine she'd pulled my thoughts directly off my expression.
"I file in the front office. One of my dad's salesmen is married to the front office secretary. Never hurts to have connections. Not that you'd know anything about it."
I'd known Marcy's dad was influential in Coldwater. In fact, he was such a large booster club donor he had a say in every coaching position at the high school. But this was ridiculous.
"Once in a while, a file falls open, and I can't help but see things," Marcy said.
"Yeah, right.
For example, I know you're still not over your dad's death. You've been in counseling with the school psych. In fact, I know everything about everyone, except Patch. Last week, I noticed his file is empty. I want to know why. I want to know what he's hiding."
"Why do you care?"
"He was standing in my driveway last night, staring at my bedroom window."
I blinked. "Patch was standing in your driveway?"
"Unless you know some other guy who drives a Jeep Commander, dresses in all black, and is super hot."
I frowned. "Did he say anything?"
"He saw me watching from the window and left. Should I be thinking about a restraining order? Is this typical behavior for him? I know he's off, but just how off are we talking?"
I ignored her, too absorbed with turning over this information. Patch? At Marcy's? It had to have been after he left my place. After I said, "I love you," and he bailed.
"No problem," Marcy said, straightening up. "There are other ways to get information, like administration. I'm guessing they'd be all over an empty school file. I wasn't going to say anything, but for my own safety."
I wasn't worried about Marcy going to administration. Patch could handle himself. I was worried about last night. Patch had left abruptly, claiming he had something he needed to do, but I was having a hard time believing that something was hanging out in Marcy's driveway. It was a lot easier to accept that he'd left because of what I'd said.
"Or the police," Marcy added, tapping her fingertip to her lip. "An empty school file almost sounds illegal. How did Patch get into school?" "You look upset, Nora. Am I on to something?"
A smile of surprised pleasure dawned on her face.
"I am, aren't I? There's more to the story."
I settled cool eyes on her. "For someone who's made it clear that her life is superior to every other student's at this school, you sure make it a habit of pursuing every facet of our boring, worthless lives." Marcy's smile vanished.
"I wouldn't have to if you all would stay out of my way."
"Your way? This isn't your school."
"Don't talk to me that way," Marcy said with a disbelieving, almost involuntary tick of her head. "In fact, don't talk to me at all."
I flipped my palms up. "No problem."
"And while you're at it, move."
I glanced down at my stool, thinking surely she couldn't mean, "I was here first." Mimicking me, Marcy flipped her palms up.
"Not my problem.
I'm not moving.
I'm not sitting by you.
I'm happy to hear it."
"Move,"
Marcy commanded.
"No."
The bell cut across us, and when the shrill sound of it died, both Marcy and I seemed to have realized the room had grown quiet. We glanced around, and it hit me with a souring to my stomach that every other seat in the room was taken. Mr. Lux positioned himself in the aisle to my right, waving a sheet of paper.
"I'm holding a blank seating chart," he said. "Each of the rectangles corresponds to a desk in the room.
Write your name in the appropriate rectangle and pass it on.
He slapped the chart down in front of me.
Hope you like your partners, he told us. You've got 8 weeks with them.
At noon, when class ended, I caught a ride with V to Enzo's Bistro, our favorite place to grab iced mochas or steamed milk, depending on the season. I felt the sun bake my face as we crossed the parking lot, and that's when I saw it. A white convertible Volkswagen Cabriolet with a sale sign taped in the window. $1,000 or best offer.
You're drooling, V said, using her finger to tip my chin closed.
You don't happen to have $1,000 I can borrow.
I don't have 5 you can borrow. My piggy bank is officially anorexic.
I gave a sigh of longing in the direction of the cabriolet. I need money. I need a job. I shut my eyes, envisioning myself behind the wheel of the cabriolet, the top down, the wind swishing my curly hair. With the cabriolet, I'd never have to bum a ride again. I'd be free to go where I wanted, when I pleased.
Yeah, but getting a job means you actually have to work. I mean, are you sure you want to blow the entire summer laboring away at minimum wage? You might, I don't know, break a sweat or something.
I dug through my backpack for a scrap of paper and scribbled down the number listed on the sign. Maybe I could talk the owner down a couple hundred. In the meantime, I added browsing the classifieds for part-time employment to my afternoon to-do list. A job meant time away from Patch, but it also meant private transportation. Much as I loved Patch, he always seemed to be busy, doing something, which made him unreliable when it came to rides. Inside Enzo's, V and I placed orders for iced mochas and spicy pecan salads and plopped down with our food at a table. Over the past several weeks, Enzo's had undergone extensive remodeling to bring it up to speed with the 21st century, and Coldwater now had its very first internet lounge. Given the fact that my home computer was 6 years old, I was actually excited about this.
I don't know about you, but I'm ready for vacation, V said, pushing her sunglasses to the top of her head. 8 more weeks of Spanish. That's more days than I want to think about. What we need is a distraction. We need something that will take our minds off this endless stretch of quality education spread out before us. We need to go shopping. Portland, here we come. Macy's is having a big sale. I need shoes, I need dresses, and I need a new fragrance.
You just bought new clothes. $200 worth. Your mom is going to hemorrhage when she gets her MasterCard statement.
Yeah, but I need a boyfriend. And to get a boyfriend, you have to look good. Doesn't hurt to smell good, too.
I bit a diced pear off my fork. Have anybody in mind?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Just promise me it's not Scott Parnell.
Scott who?
I smiled. See? Now I'm happy.
I don't know about any Scott Parnells, but the guy I've got my eye on happens to be hot. Off the charts hot. Hotter than Patch hot. She paused. Well, maybe not that hot. Nobody's that hot. Seriously, the rest of my day is a wash. Portland or bust, I say.
I opened my mouth, but V was faster.
Uh-oh, she said. I know that look. You're going to tell me you already have plans.
Rewind to Scott Parnell. He used to live here when we were 5. V looked like she was searching her long-term memory.
He wet his pants a lot,
I offered helpfully. V's eyes lit up.
Scotty the potty?
He's moving back to Coldwater. My mom invited him over for dinner tonight.
I see where this is going, V said, nodding sagely. This is what's called the meet cute. This is when the lives of 2 potential romantic partners intersect. Remember when Desi accidentally walked into the men's room and caught Ernesto at the urinal?
I stopped with my fork halfway between my plate and my mouth.
What?
On Corazon, the Spanish soap?
No?
Never mind. Your mom wants to hook you and Scotty the potty up. Pronto.
No, she doesn't. She knows I'm with Patch.
Just because she knows doesn't mean she's happy about it. Your mom is going to spend a lot of time and energy turning this equation from Nora plus Patch equals love to Nora plus Scotty the potty equals love. And what about this? Maybe Scotty the potty turned into Scotty the hottie,
Have you thought about that?
I hadn't, and I wasn't going to either. I had Patch, and I was perfectly happy to keep it that way.
Can we talk about something slightly more urgent? I asked, thinking